The roadside robberies were also a frequent feature. Some mounted jats near the tank of a Brahmin woman on this side of Sikandra attacked on travelers and looted whatever they found in their possession and also wounded them. The document dated 1112 Dhul-Hijjah, 1139 AH, also mentions that the jats were doing much vagrancy and plundering in the vicinity of the city since last 15 days. They were plundering the cattle in the villages and looting the travelers. Glimpses of the administration of Agra under Muhammad Shah, Muhammad Afzal Khan, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 54, 1993. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion of the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-1, The Playboy. Growing Anti-Sayyid Sentiments. Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila appointed Muhammad Amin Khan, a Turani noble, as Grand Vizier in 1720. Muhammad Amin Khan's cousin was Chin Kalish Khan. Chin Kalish held the title of Nizamul Mulk and was the governor of Malwa on the border of the Deccan. Muhammad Amin Khan and Nizamul Mulk Chin Kalish Khan had stayed neutral in the Sayyid brothers' court intrigues. Nonetheless, the Sayyid brothers did not like the fact that the emperor had appointed Muhammad Amin Khan as Grand Vizier without their permission. Sayyid Hussein, one of the Sayyid brothers, wanted to kill the emperor, but his brother Sayyid Abdullah, that is the other Sayyid brother, was afraid that might start a revolt. After all, three different puppet emperors had died under the Sayyid brothers' watch. Instead, the Sayyid brothers demanded the emperor dismiss Muhammad Amin Khan, but when the emperor hesitated, they gave him a month to make up his mind. This was an implied threat, and it was obvious, and the emperor and his mother and his grandmother were fearing for his life. The Sayyid brothers had a history of getting rid of emperors that didn't go along with what they said. The Sayyid brothers also wanted to remove Nizamul Mulk from Malwa due to its strategic importance. Sayyid Hussein went on ahead and appointed himself as governor of Malwa, but Nizamul Mulk refused to step down. Meanwhile, the emperor's female relatives came up with a plan to keep him alive. His milk sister, Koki B, and his grandmother, Mahar Pawar, conspired with Muhammad Amin Khan and Nizamul Mulk so that together they would orchestrate the downfall of the Sayyid brothers. Now, just a quick aside. Milk brother and milk sister, this means two children who were nursed by the same woman, even though they were not biologically siblings. In Islam, boys and girls who are nursed by the same woman are considered siblings. And just like biological brothers and sisters, the girl doesn't have to wear the hijab in the presence of her milk brother. However, just like biological siblings, the milk brother and the milk sister are forbidden from marrying each other. Fighting in the Deccan. Now, the Sayyid brothers knew something was going on, but they weren't quite sure what it was. Meanwhile, Nizamul Mulk led his forces to Burhanpur, where a large army of Sayyids, who were supported by Afghans and Rajputs, were stationed. The Sayyid army was more experienced and stronger, and they were confident of an easy victory against Nizamul Mulk. Well, the two sides fought in June 1720 at Ratanpur, near Burhanpur and Malwa. Initially, Nizamul Mulk's army was losing. But then, the Sayyid general was killed by a musket shot, and this led to panic in the Sayyid ranks, and the armies eventually fled the battlefield. And just like that, Nizamul Mulk had won the first major battle. After the battle was over, the Sayyids tried to reconcile with the Mughal emperor and offered the governorship of Deccan to Nizamul Mulk. But Nizamul Mulk refused to work under the Sayyid brothers' authority. Shortly after that, Nizamul Mulk faced another Sayyid army in August of 1720. Once again, the Sayyid general was killed along with many of his senior officers and commanders, and the Sayyid army was routed. The Sayed brothers had just been defeated twice by Nizam al-Mulk, and they were furious. In early September 1720, Sayed Hussein led an army himself to go take care of Nizam al-Mulk. Sayed Hussein had reluctantly included Turanis in his army to increase his size, but this was going to soon backfire against him. Now, we discussed the friction between the Turanis and Iranis in the previous season. The Turanis were the nobility that were descended from Central Asia, while the Iranis were the Persians who supported the Sayed brothers. It shouldn't come as a surprise that the Sayed brothers were also Shiites, while most of the Turanis were Sunni. The Sayed brothers brought the emperor to the battle as a sign of imperial support. But this was very ironic, since it was the emperor himself who had set all these things in motion with his conspiracy with Nizam al-Mulk. However, Nizam al-Mulk and Muhammad Amin Khan, they knew the emperor was being forced to go along with this. Now, just an interesting note. The imperial encampment was called Urdu-i-Mu'alla, which means exalted military camp. This later gave its name to the Urdu language. Now back to the story. Emperor Muhammad Shah did not know that his sister and his mother had planted an assassin on this campaign. The assassin managed to talk his way into close proximity of Sayed Hussein's tent, which was on a palanquin. A palanquin is a large covered box carried on two poles by four men. Once he was close enough, the assassin stabbed Sayed Hussein in the heart with a poison dagger. Then he dragged Sayed Hussein from his palanquin and beheaded him. A nearby family member of the Sayed brothers pulled out a pistol and shot the assassin on the spot, but then the nearby Mughal soldiers pounced on the Sayed family member who had killed the assassin. Pretty soon, a fight broke out between the Iranis and the Turanis, and during the fighting between these two groups, the Sayed camps were burned down. Eventually, the fighting settled down. However, Sayed Abdullah was furious about his brother's assassination. He wrote an angry letter demanding the emperor execute the assassin and everyone connected to the plot. But the emperor didn't know anything about this plot, and so he truthfully replied that he knew nothing about it and that the assassin was already dead. Frustrated with this response from the emperor, Sayed Abdullah began looking for some prince that he could install on the throne and get rid of Muhammad Shah. However, most of the princes in the palace refused to cooperate and to participate in this scheme. Sayed Abdullah finally found his patsy in Zahiruddin Ibrahim. Zahiruddin Ibrahim was the son of Rafi'u Shan and brother of the two briefly ruling Rafia emperors. Rafi'u Shan was one of the sons of Bahadur Shah, and Bahadur Shah was the son and successor of Aurangzeb, so Zahiruddin Ibrahim did have some legitimacy. Sayed Abdullah then raised a large army of 90,000 men to take on the Mughal army and overthrow the emperor. However, most of the soldiers in his army were inexperienced men that he had drawn from local villages. Well, the two armies met at Hasanpur in Uttar Pradesh in northern India, and the fighting began on November 13, 1720. During the night, the Mughal army lit up the sky with cannon fire. Sayed Abdullah's inexperienced troops got spooked by this bombardment and abandoned camp. With his army defeated, Sayed Abdullah and the pretender Zahiruddin Ibrahim were arrested. 2 years later, in October 1722, Koki B ordered Sayed Abdullah to be poisoned. And that was the end of the reign of the Sayed brothers. Nizam al-Mulk. With the Sayed brothers gone, Muhammad Amin Khan was confirmed as the Mughal Grand Vizier. However, he suddenly died 3 months later, quite possibly from poisoning. With his death, Nizam al-Mulk replaced him as Grand Vizier. As Nizam al-Mulk traveled from the Deccan to Delhi to take up his new post, a few instances occur that highlight the respect that people had for Nizam al-Mulk. Maharaja Jai Singh was a Rajput leader who had previously rebelled during the reign of Bahadur Shah back in 1709. He had even pillaged Mewat in northwestern India. However, he suddenly asked for peace when he heard that Nizam al-Mulk had been appointed as Grand Vizier. Also, the governor of Ajmer had started causing trouble in the province. Nizam-ul-Mulk took a slight detour on his journey to deal with this troublesome governor. However, the Nawab's officers refused to fight against him. The Nawab, or the governor, fled to Mawad and used his connections to obtain a royal pardon. After that, Nizam-ul-Mulk headed to Bhopal in Madhya Pradesh to deal with another rebellious Nawab. Nizam-ul-Mulk did not trust this Nawab as he had previously supported the Sayyid brothers. Nizam-ul-Mulk eventually forced this Nawab to give up territory and hostages to ensure his loyalty. Nizam-ul-Mulk finally arrived in Delhi in 1723 and was shocked by the decadence he found in the emperor's court. The emperor indulged in wine, women, and music, and was surrounded by corrupt individuals like Kamaruddin and Kani Duran. We'll learn more about these two guys in the coming episodes, inshallah. Nizam-ul-Mulk tried to advise the emperor to do better, but all this did was alienate him from the emperor. Also, Koki Bey was whispering in the emperor's ear, helping to turn him against Nizam-ul-Mulk. Nizam-ul-Mulk was also concerned about events taking place in the neighboring Safavid Empire. A man named Nadir Shah was challenging the Safavid dynasty. Nizam-ul-Mulk advised his emperor to help the Safavids out, but Rangila ignored him. The Mughal Empire would soon pay a heavy price for not heeding the Nizam's advice in this regard. Disgusted by the behavior and the decadence of the emperor, Nizam-ul-Mulk appointed his son, Ghaziuddin, as deputy grand vizier to manage the empire's affairs. Then Nizam-ul-Mulk packed his bags and returned to the Deccan. Shortly after that, however, the emperor replaced Ghaziuddin, basically fired Nizam-ul-Mulk's son, and replaced him with Kamaruddin as deputy grand vizier. Kamaruddin was the son of the former grand vizier, Muhammad Amin Khan. The emperor also ordered the governor of Hyderabad to go to war against Nizam-ul-Mulk. If the governor defeated Nizam-ul-Mulk, then he would be rewarded with the governorship of the Deccan. Well, the two sides fought at the Battle of Sharkhkida, about 80 miles from Aurangabad, in October 1724. The governor of Hyderabad was killed in battle, and Nizam-ul-Mulk was victorious. After this, the emperor sent a bunch of letters denying any involvement and confirmed Nizam-ul-Mulk as governor of the Deccan. From this point onward, the Deccan became fully autonomous with hardly any intervention from Delhi. Yes, the khutbah was still read, and coins were still struck in Emperor Muhammad Shah's name, but the real power in the Deccan was with Nizam-ul-Mulk. Rangila, the Playboy King. Ruling this rich, vulnerable empire was the effete Emperor Muhammad Shah, called Rangila, or Colorful, the Merrymaker. He was an aesthete, much given to wearing ladies' peshwas and shoes embroidered with pearls. He was also a discerning patron of music and painting. Muhammad Shah somehow managed to survive in power by the simple rules of giving up any appearance of ruling. In the morning, he watched partridge and elephant fights. In the afternoon, he was entertained by jugglers, mime artists, and conjurers. Politics he wisely left to his advisors and regents, and as his reign progressed, power ebbed gently away from Delhi as the regional Nawabs began to take their own decisions on all important matters of politics, economics, internal security, and self-defense. William Dalrymple, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila's mother and grandmother died soon after Nizam-ul-Mulk left Delhi. And with no one to restrain him, the emperor descended into sheer depravity. Nobles learned they could garner favor by bringing beautiful women to the emperor. He built the Hayat Baksh Garden outside Delhi for lavish parties with wine and dancing girls. Ada Begum, an Iranian dancer, became the emperor's favorite. Her specialty was dancing with a dress painted on her naked body. But she was also a spy for the Persian ruler, Nadir Shah. We'll discuss him more in the next episode, inshallah. as his depravity grew, the emperor built another garden, Mehtabag, for moonlit parties. The emperor's moral corruption spread to the public, making Delhi a city of sin. Kasalpura, a special red light district, was soon established, and the emperor earned the nickname he would forever be known by, Rangila, meaning colorful or playboy. Rangila neglected his imperial duties, so his milk sister, Koki B, handled them instead. Of course, she was embezzling funds from the imperial treasury. She made a habit of skimming money that was meant to pay for expenses in Kabul, and she destroyed the letters of complaint that the governor of Kabul was sending into Delhi. Eventually, she just stopped sending money to Kabul altogether. Somehow, the governor's complaints eventually got through to the emperor, and Muhammad Shah finally learned that his troops in Kabul hadn't been paid for months and were deserting. The emperor then had Koki B and her conspirator, Roshanu Daula, imprisoned, but they managed to escape and fled to Persia. The Maratha Attack. The Marathas had been a thorn in the Mughal side since the reign of Shah Jahan, and their issues, their problems, had not been resolved even after Aurangzeb's long campaign that we discussed extensively in the previous season. In March 1737, the Marathas began pillaging and raiding areas in northern India around Agra. Two Maratha leaders were leading these attacks: Baji Rao, who was the Maratha Peshwa, and Malhar Holkar, who was a Maratha noble. In fact, Malhar Holkar's forces got within 15 miles of Agra. Saadat Khan, also known as Burhanul Mulk, was the Nawab of Awadh, and he countered the Marathas with 50,000 Mughal soldiers. Doing so, he forced the Marathas to flee. But this was just a diversion. While the Mughals were fighting Holkar's forces, Baji Rao's forces were moving on Delhi. Holkar then circled back around to join Baji Rao for a major assault on the capital. And with most of the Mughal forces deployed against Holkar, there were only 32,000 troops to defend Delhi. The emperor sent an urgent plea to Nizamul Mulk, begging him to come, and he soon arrived in Bhopal with 50,000 soldiers in December 1737. However, the combined Maratha army was larger, consisting of 80,000 troops. The Marathas surrounded Nizam's troops, but he was able to use his artillery to keep them at bay for a while. But eventually, the Nizam realized that there was no way to win, and he had to sue for peace. A treaty was signed in January 1738, granting the Marathas Malwa province and some reparations. This temporarily ended the Maratha threat, but the Marathas would continue to be a problem for decades to come. Inshallah, in the next episode, we'll discuss Nadir Shah's invasion of Delhi. For those of you with young kids, I know how tough it can be to teach them Islamic history. Kids just want to play, right? But alhamdulillah, some amazing Muslim creatives have made it easier. They've developed a fun game called Time Hoppers, where kids travel through the golden age of Islam, learning about Muslim scientists and scholars. They even worked with historians to make sure it's accurate. You can download it for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And be sure to check out MuslimKids.tv for more fun and educational Islamic content, including a high-quality 3D animated version of Time Hoppers coming soon, inshallah. Use coupon code IslamicHistoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, for 20% off an annual subscription to MuslimKids TV. Spread the word. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Meanwhile, of course, the Umayyads were still trying to push forward in North Africa, as well as fighting against the Byzantines in Anatolia. The Umayyads were fighting and trying to expand everywhere. They're fighting in North Africa, trying to expand the caliphate there, fighting the Byzantines in Anatolia, and fighting the Turks and Sogdians and Chinese in Central Asia. Meanwhile, the new caliph, Caliph al-Walid, he appointed a man named Omar ibn Abdulaziz as governor of Medina. Yes, that Omar who would eventually become the caliph of the Umayyad dynasty. During this period, while Omar ibn Abdulaziz was governor of Medina, reconstruction of the Prophet's mosque in Medina began. This is roughly around 88 AH. Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, still the governor of Iraq, he appointed a man named Muhammad ibn Qasim al-Thaqafi. He was from actually Hajjaj's clan. He appointed Muhammad ibn Qasim to attack Sindh in 90 AH. And this began the Muslim conquest of the Indian subcontinent, but really more or less what we now consider Pakistan. The first major success for the Umayyads in the Indian subcontinent was when they captured Daybul, which is a port city near what is now Karachi, Pakistan. This port city fell in 93 AH. Meanwhile, back in Damascus, Caliph al-Walid was beginning to centralize more authority in Damascus, which was a shift away from the decentralized system that most of the caliphs before him, going all the way back to Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, most of the caliphs had favored a more decentralized system, whereas Caliph al-Walid was trying to control things more in Damascus. One of the ways he did this was to begin maintaining a standing army. No more just making calls out from the minbar, from the pulpit, calling for men to take up arms and join the army. Now they began to maintain a standing army, which was a significant shift in ideology from the original, somewhat tribal ways of the early caliphs, including the righteous caliphs. They still followed more of a tribal practice where when it was time to fight, you just make the call and different tribes will come and join. Anyway, so this is a shift for the Umayyads. Meanwhile, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, he, for some reason, and we explain it more in the actual series, but I don't want to go into it right now. Hajjaj ibn Yusuf took a huge dislike towards Yazid ibn Muhallab and the other descendants of Muhallab, who was, both of them actually, were former governors of Khurasan, both Muhallab and his son Yazid ibn Muhallab. Hajjaj ibn Yusuf imprisoned Yazid ibn Muhallab and several of his brothers, and he tortured and persecuted some of them as well. Yazid ibn Muhallab and his brothers escaped from prison and headed towards Palestine. The governor of Palestine at this time was Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik, who was the son of the former caliph Abdul Malik and the brother of the current caliph al-Walid. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik didn't really care for his brother too much, and since his brother supported and liked Hajjaj, Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik didn't like Hajjaj either. Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik accepted Yazid ibn Muhallab and his brothers as refugees in Palestine, and Muhallab's family began shifting away from Khorasan and Iraq towards Palestine, began moving to Palestine to escape Hajjaj ibn Yusuf's persecution. During this period, Sulayman ibn Abdul Malik and Yazid ibn Muhallab became close friends. Meanwhile, the Umayyads were still continuing their push across North Africa. This push was led by a commander named Musa ibn Nusayr, who had established himself in Kardawan, which was the capital of Ifriqiya. Now, we know that Ifriqiya means Africa, but during this period of time, Ifriqiya was the name of the Umayyad province of North Africa, which really only included Libya and northern Tunisia. It did not include Egypt, and it did not include Algeria or Morocco because those hadn't been conquered yet. But that would soon change. Musa ibn Nusayr led the Umayyad forces to sweep across Algeria and into northern Africa. From there, Musa ibn Nusayr appointed his Berber Mawla, a man named Tariq ibn Ziyad, as the governor of Tangier. Tariq ibn Ziyad began the invasion of Al-Andalus, which is, of course, Spain and Portugal, or the Iberian Peninsula, if you'd rather say that. He began the invasion in 711 CE, which corresponds to 92 AH. Tariq defeated King Rodrigo of Al-Andalus, and he continued north towards Cordoba, eventually capturing Cordoba and Toledo.